Okay, so I'm Alan Calder of SUNY Stony Brook. I like to think of them as recently poaching me from the Flash Center. The work I'm going to talk about here is stuff I'm still active with, but not as active as when I was at the Flash Center, and it represents progress toward the realistic Type 1A supernova models that are being done by some at the Flash Center. I'll mention Dean Townsley, who's here, who's one of the driving forces or big cheeses in this work, and Shimon Aceta, who is in Israel, also had a lot to do with it, and then Ivo Zeitensal and Fong Ping were grad students we had the pleasure of working with. Also, I should mention that Tomek Pleva contributed to the very early parts of this work, but to our knowledge, the things he's running do not use any of these results presented here. I frame no hypothesis for what he is currently doing, so that I should make a note that there has been sort of a fork there. But, so, improvements to the flame model. So the bulk of my talk is about a model flame for use in the deflagration phase of a Type 1A supernova. The idea is that a deflagration is born in the core of a carbon-oxygen white dwarf as it approaches the Chandrasekhar mass. Something happens and that eventually consumes the star fast enough to produce the outburst that we see. I'm going to talk about the energetics of the flame, that is the energy release and the timescales for the release, and the post-flame evolution. You turn on weak reactions and the NSE ash neutronizes. It can also evolve hydrodynamically in the case of a rising bubble, which, as I will show, is the case we're quite interested in. Then there's the issue of the noise and stability of the model. In addition to the energetics, we're interested in fluid instabilities in this problem, particularly the Rayleigh-Taylor instability. And so if you have a very noisy model, that can seed spurious instabilities, or it can produce spurious seeds of instabilities that will develop. So it's important to quantify that. And I'll also mention, if we have time, though I'm not betting on it, that the model we used is a thickened advection diffusion reaction scheme, and I'll explain what that means. And it, as a thick flame, has curvature effects that are unphysical, so you need to work on that as well. And the ongoing verification of a turbulent subgrid scale model for the boosting effects of Rayleigh-Taylor instability on the scales that you can't resolve in your multidimensional simulation of the flame. And then just for those, the purists of the numerical effort, particularly those former flashers who are here, there are quite a few of us, we recently migrated to the non-permanent guard cell mode of Paramesh for significant memory saving. Flash up to the 2.5 level had to have a set of species for it, and we have switched to evolving YE and binding energy, where you don't have to have as many species. So some of what I'm going to present was from the code with the species, and we've established that as a baseline and then tested the new formalism against that. And we're also working on doing gravity better, stronger, and faster to also improve the model.
Stronger?
Okay, a little hyperbole there. And I should say, I'm looking on this as an informal seminar, so don't be shy about asking questions. I've been working on this stuff for years, and it may not be quite as obvious to everybody as to what I'm talking about as it is to me, and that's a frequent occurrence in my talks, but we'll try to make that better here.
When you go to non-permanent guard cells, communication cost goes up.
So there is some overhead for that, but it's not.
Still a win.
It's still a win, yeah.
So communication cost doesn't change, but sort of like bookkeeping costs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it changes the pattern of the communication, but you still have to. And of course, it's not a complete win in that you basically have to keep a copy of things as well. But it,
okay, thank you.
Does that answer the question? Okay. So astrophysical flames. I should also note that my flames are propagating both to the left and to the right in the talk here, so I'll try to have that labeled.
You're being politically neutral.
I'm being politically neutral, that's right. So you have a region of pre-mixed fuel, pre-mixed in that there's no, you know, it's ready to burn. You don't have to, like in a chemical flame, add an oxidizer or something like that. And astrophysical flames propagate heat that into this fuel, which then initiates the reactions. This is the abundance that then for the fuel that then changes, and the temperature rises up, and you get it. Now, we can say that these are large Lewis number flames, which means that the thermal conductivity or thermal diffusion is much more important than material diffusion. And this is a simple one reaction case of a deflagration. So keep this in mind, that this is the heart of what I'm going to talk about modeling here. And then somewhat aside, this is a subsonic deflagration. It's propagating below the speed of sound. The alternative is a detonation, which is a supersonic wave going through, where you have a very fast burning shortly after the shock that follows through. Most contemporary 1A models invoke a transition to a detonation. I'm going to mention that in explaining the model that we're going after and show a mechanism for it, but the talk is going to be completely concerned with deflagrations.
Are you distinguishing deflagration from flame? Or are you using those
synonymously? I'm using those synonymously, yeah. So here's a schematic of a flame born in the center of a type 1A supernova. And you have hot ash that has expanded some. It's degenerate, but it's still going to expand some. And that drives Rayleigh-Taylor instability here. The increase in the surface area boosts the flame speed because you're making more fuel come in contact with the hot ash. And so you're going to have a faster burning. And the white dwarf is about the size of the Earth. The nuclear flame is about the size of my thumb, at least at high densities. So the whole point of having the model is to be able to resolve, or not resolve, but to have in your simulation something that you can't resolve. That's the flame model. So I want to be careful about the language here. I'm talking about a model for an artificially thickened flame that can propagate across the grid. In addition to that, as I noted here, this Rayleigh-Taylor instability boosts the burning. And physically, that'll be on scales below, at least much of it will be on scales below that which you can resolve in the grid. So you also need a model for that turbulent combustion. And as was alluded to yesterday, I believe there was considerable controversy about that some weeks ago here. But my point here is that the language, you've got a flame model and you've got a subgrid scale turbulent flame speed model. We use this advection diffusion reaction scheme to propagate the thickened flame. And as I mentioned, the subgrid model is designed to capture the effects of the Rayleigh-Taylor instability on unresolved scales. If there's time, I'll talk a little bit about that. The bulk of my talk is going to be about this advection diffusion reaction scheme for this question.
Yeah, before you move on, for those of us who are not doing this at all, you know, when you're talking about things that are not resolvable in the context of your calculation, mm-hmm. presumably there are other people who have worked on
the microphysics of it.
Right.
Yes.
So just, can you say a few words about making that connection?
So that's exactly what I'm trying to do in the talk here. People like Mike Zingali work on fully resolved flames and do direct numerical simulations of some of these problems. And what we're trying to do is come up with a model that matches that result that we can use when we can't resolve what you would need to do the direct numerical.
So you're basically using that input mm-hmm. to create the model.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ideally.
I don't think
we're there yet.
Yeah, this gets into the issue of verification and validation of codes, which is an important but far from well-resolved issue, and that is, how do you know, for example, that your model is meaningfully describing nature in the flame? And so I'm going to present some tests that will make that argument, but we're not quite to the point of completely comparing to direct numerical simulations. But I'll have some of that, so I'll show you. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. Okay.
Before you go on.
Yeah.
All the wrinkles that you show there, that you mentioned, are increasing the flame speed. It's only going to be the unresolved wrinkles that increase the flame speed. Is that correct? Because the flame speed you just showed me on the previous slide was a little local thing that doesn't know about large-scale stuff.
Correct. So
if they're large resolved wrinkles, they're not changing the flame speed.
If they're large resolved wrinkles, they're changing, the way to put it is they're changing the overall rate of consuming fuel,
which is not the same as the flame speed.
Okay, that's
so
right.
I keep hitting
yeah. No. This.
For you, it's you flip back.
Well, like I said, ask me questions if
that's why I wanted to ask. So there's sort of an average flame speed that it's moving out, but then the local little flame speed at sort of at the lowest level you're resolving is going to be determined by your the subgrid unresolved.
Exactly. Exactly. The code makes a choice of the maximum of this turbulent subgrid model or the laminar.
Okay.
And the turbulent subgrid model exceeds the laminar when the physics says that there's a boost from this Rayleigh-Taylor that you're not resolving.
That you're not resolving.
Yeah.
In the potash, you said it will expand a little bit, even though it's still degenerate.
Mm-hmm.
But the expansion, I mean, the what is driving the flame outwards is not the expansion of the hot ashes, of the gas that is in there. I mean, it's not the physical bulk motion of material that wants to expand.
Well, that's what's driving the Rayleigh-Taylor, but of course the flame is propagating out itself. So,
right.
So there's both.
Right. But I mean, which one is dominant? Is it the bulk motion of material, or is it just the flame that is propagating outward because of the heat diffusion?
So I believe it's the flame propagating out because of the heat diffusion, at least for a while. Early on, the expansion isn't that great, but of course, eventually the star is going to expand. At some point, degeneracy will lift and so forth and so on.
Well, there's three things, right? There's sort of volume creation is something that's mm-hmm. called sometimes when the density change in density makes expansion.
Right.
That's almost always a small effect,
yeah.
even when degeneracy was. Then there's hydrodynamic motions driven by the buoyancy,
mm-hmm.
which is what generates the Rayleigh-Taylor. And then there's the flame propagation.
Okay.
So there's three components to them.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. So here's one scenario for blowing up a type 1A, and I'm just going to show this to give you an idea of the problem that we're after and where these things come into play in it.
Now,
yeah.
What are we seeing right now?
Yep. this is a plot of temperature, and it's from a 2D axisymmetric simulation. Here's the temperature scale, 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 10. This is the surface of the star, and you can imagine it as a little ball that we're taking a cross-section through. And it's a hydrodynamic simulation, so there is gas on the grid everywhere, okay? And that, out above the star, there's a very thin atmosphere that kind of collapses down and shock heats at the surface of the star, which is why the surface is hot here, okay?
Why is the atmosphere collapsing? Just so, in order to pull this thing into hydrostatic equilibrium, it was evolved for a little while.
Yeah.
And so there's a shock layer at the surface because there's a very low density medium outside the star
right.
that can fall. And so it's low density shocked gas.
It's
right.
infalling.
Yeah. It's infalling, yeah. An alternative would be to put something like the sponge that Mike described yesterday. That
would be harder.
It's an alternative. Yeah, I stand by our choice here. So.
Is that meant to simulate accretion?
No.
It's
a hydrodynamic simulation, so you have to have gas everywhere on the grid. And so, out here, I mean, this is literally a density of like, I don't know, 10 grams per cubic centimeter, something just tiny.
In the real world, though, presumably the star is accreting.
Presumably, yeah.
Would that be the physics that
I think you should run this and then explain what's happening.
Okay.
Run it.
Okay. Well,
it's not important.
The answer is yes, but it's not as people are anticipating.
Draw into what's
fair
not
enough.
Relevant to your
right.
problem.
Okay, so
run it, you're going to see something else happen.
There is a little match head here that you can't see that's going up the z-axis. It's slightly off-center. Yeah, it's running already. It's slightly off-center. And it's developing. Here it comes. Now watch carefully, and you'll see a shock form. See that?
Yeah.
How perfect.
Gee, the shock.
It's not exploding.
Okay, so now there's a ever so slightly offset ignition point there, and it's ever so slightly. It's 50 kilometers in radius, and it's offset by 12. But it rises very quickly, and it forms a shock. So it's rising supersonically, okay? And that pushes material out in this big wave or sort of a tsunami that, if you imagine the whole 3D thing, is going to be focusing all around. And just like a tidal wave passing an island, it focuses back here. And what we found was that the conditions are okay and we're arguing with people about this, but you can get close to igniting a detonation here, and here we just ignited one right there, and it will eventually incinerate the star. Now, I can just a couple words about the thing. I didn't show it, but because you're moving mass out of the center, the star expands somewhat, which is what we expect for a successful model, because that way you get burning to things other than just nickel. And it's also essentially a 1D problem at this point, so you expect a mild degree of asymmetry, which is in keeping with some of the observations. Now, what's important about this and why I showed it is that rising bubble, because the buoyancy of the bubble sets a lot of the dynamics here. Particularly, it's going to do things like establish the velocity here, how far up it goes. That one, I showed you the shock. It went supersonic. But that was a mistake that we made. We got the energetics wrong. We were essentially burning everything to nickel. And it turns out that nickel is not NSE, that you have a mix of alpha particles in that, and you get a lot less binding energy. Now, the mechanism is still reasonably robust. I mean, we can, the same thing happens, but it doesn't go quite that fast. And to understand and quantify how this can work, you have to get the energetics right. That's the take-home point from this simulation question.
When you have this plume coming up on one side, let's say North Pole, then there's the sort of the wave travels all the way around. And why does it ignite the star on the South Pole?
Because that's where it meets flow from all sides of the star, and there's a compression here that gets things compressed and hot enough that we believe will ignite a detonation.
Why does it detonate? I mean, the first one is a deflagration.
The first one's a deflagration.
So why is it a detonation when it converges on the...
Well, it's essentially... it's ignition because it's inertially confined here. We call it gravitationally confined, but it's just the compression of that, and that's what you get. It's...
But it's not colliding shockwaves. You have a couple of focused shockwaves
right,
and
right.
Yeah. Bang. Right. You raise the temperature of a piece of mass high that you may ignite a detonation.
But why does it detonate?
I think it may ignite.
May ignite is the key. I don't want to get into a debate over that.
Material,
yeah.
But if you get enough material hot enough, you'll get a detonation.
Yeah,
it all burns at once.
That's,
you generate an overpressure and you drive it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's
hot enough and you will detonate.
Put cheap gas in your car.
But you don't get that in the center. In the one.
No. See, that's where the compression is right here. So.
And that's because it doesn't get hot enough.
Well, that's what we're showing is it gets, but the interior of the star is relatively cool, we think.
Okay.
So the point is that buoyancy is important, and that is determined by the energetics. Okay, so we used the thick flame based on an advection reaction diffusion equation model described in Kokolov 95. I don't think Kokolov did this originally, but that's where I learned about it, and like they told me in high school, you put the reference that you learned. Flame speed is an input parameter to the model, where, as I mentioned, we choose the maximum of the laminar or this subgrid model. The laminar comes from Timmison Woosley. The subgrid is from Kokolov, and if I have time, I'll talk about some of the verification of that. And as I mentioned, there are two principal parts of the problem. The flame model itself, the ADR scheme, and then this subgrid scale model for the turbulent combustion owing to the Rayleigh-Taylor. So now, we show the equations. We've got the Euler equations for compressible dynamics. There's an equation of state appropriate. New gravity, and there's a species equation that involves scalars that can do species as well as the passive scalar or the mass scalar that's going to describe this ADR scheme. I put a zero here because that's what it solves, but there's actually a source because the flame itself changes that. So you could have a, like Mike's term yesterday, the omega. Now, the ADR scheme, you have an advection diffusion reaction equation where the coefficients and the reaction turn are set to reproduce the input flame speed in the laminar case. And there are choices of reactions that you can make. There's the top hat, where you react at a constant rate for some limit on the mass scalar phi that controls it. There's the KPP, which has this form, and then the shifted KPP, where you shift that ever so slightly, which has better properties. And that's actually one of the take-homes that we'll get to is that this is not noisy, and it also does not have that much of a curvature effect.
But the motivation of this is so that you can resolve. You want to have the flame resolved on your match. Is that the?
You want a flame model that does what it should even though you can't actually resolve it physically. So you want yeah, I guess that's a good way to put it. Essentially a resolved flame.
You're forcing it.
You're forcing it to be resolved, yeah. Yeah.
What's the shift itself do? What, you say it makes things better, but what physically does that correspond to?
This is just, you just make this stuff up.
No. It,
huh?
Actually...
No, it makes it... it gives you a stable flame sheet. The KVP doesn't actually have a well-defined flame sheet.
Right.
The epsilons actually make it bistable and give you a stable flame
sheet. So, I mean, they're very important.
Yeah, yeah.
They're very small and very important. So, I mean, I've said it in a very vague way, but that's... The reason you need KVP instead of the top hat is for noise.
That's right.
And the reason you need the epsilons is because the KVP itself is not actually stable in terms of the propagation speed that it gives you. So.
Which is beyond the scope of what I wanted, but thanks. That's, no. That's
I mean, the answer.
No, that's the answer to the question.
But. I'm sorry. Really dumb.
No. B is the variable that controls, it's the mass scalar, sorry? Yeah, it's the mass scalar that controls the location of this flame.
Okay, and it's the reaction progress variable.
Yeah, reaction progress variable.
This is a phenomenological flame, right? That's,
yeah.
You just, yeah. And you
yeah.
just want it to not screw up your numerics.
Yeah. Okay, we perform self-heating, that's one-zone network calculations with contemporary reaction rates, including weak reactions and Coulomb effects, to get energy release and timescales for burning. And we verify, in some sense, the self-heating calculations by comparing to the direct numerical simulations of flames where possible. Where possible means at high densities. At low densities, the flame gets very wide relative to the scales that you have to resolve, and you can't simulate it. Then we track the long-term evolution of the nuclear statistical equilibrium, the binding energy and neutronization with an NSE code consistent with these network calculations. We spend a lot of time making sure that they match as you go into long-time evolution. We incorporate this into a multi-stage flame model and dynamic NSE ash, test, and test some more, okay? And this is the bulk of the talk, although we're rapidly running out of time. So, now, here is a simulation of a direct numerical simulation of a flame that's propagating this way. Okay, so red and green are carbon and oxygen. I should use my pointer. And you see they get consumed, and then you go to heavy things like nickel. Here, actually, this is nickel. Here is the equivalent one zone calculation, and you see the curves have basically the same shape. Notice this. What is that one? That's a
carbon,
I guess. Yeah, there's a little kink here and a little kink there. Where it's burning in one zone, but using the time multiplying by the flame speed, you get the equivalent distance. So that's the. These were performed with the APROX19 network that Frank gave us. And that is the basis for comparing these one-zone calculations to the direct numerical simulation that we can. Also notice that, this again, these are nuclear flames. These are distances, you know, 10 to the minus 4 centimeters.
On the left is the burned material.
Fuel is over here, right?
Fuel is over there, and to the right is the eventual product.
Is the eventual product. These little tails here are artifacts from the unphysically high temperature that I started the thing with. So you burn to something funny. I just kicked it.
And in between is just during the burning.
That's right.
So if you were to stop the burning for some reason during that phase, you would be left with some weird...
Yeah. Well, this is a snapshot of it. I mean, if you at a certain distance behind the flame, which corresponds to a time of the flame evolving, you've got some thing like that. So here's a schematic of the flame propagation where it's propagating in this direction now. Okay, so here's carbon and oxygen get consumed. This is spread out like you would see for a low density flame, but this is a schematic, so don't worry about that. You get about half the energy liberated in the flame from consuming carbon. You get about half from the magnesium ash. And when I say magnesium ash, I mean there's a whole bunch of stuff in there, but it's roughly at the mass of magnesium. You get about 50% of the energy from going to silicon, which is nuclear statistical quasi-equilibrium. And then when you're in NSE, depending on how this evolves and the density changes, you can get about as much energy of either of those stages back out again. So this is a schematic for what this model is trying to get. No. It's 100% plus or minus 50%.
And going into latency means that you created a couple of isotopes that are unstable and you make this back into statistical equilibrium.
Exactly. Okay, so here's a lot of detail that I think we can. Nuclear statistical equilibrium code. The stuff I'm going to show had 238 nuclides in it. Now we've been doing more. Includes excited state. Includes Coulomb corrections to Helmholtz 300. Calculates energy neutrino loss rates and neutronization rates. Self-heating network code does isochoric and isobaric, meaning constant density and constant pressure, because those are better approximations in certain regimes. 200 nuclide network, temperature-dependent nuclear partition functions, and rates, again, with the Coulomb corrections in there, and screening. And as I mentioned, we got both the isobaric and isochoric results. The referee of the paper was insistent on that, which turned out to be a good thing.
So this is all done post-processing?
So this is all done pre-processing. These are the things that we're using to establish the model. So we're doing all these things, and then we're going to put that as parameters into the model. Here are the nuclides.
When you're burning, you're changing the chemical composition of the material, and you immediately take the effect of that onto the equation of state and things like that.
Yep.
Of the material, you take
that
into account.
So here are the nuclides. The boxes are what we used. The shaded ones are stable, and the pluses mark additional neutron-rich nuclides that went into the NSE calculation. And as I mentioned, more contemporary work has even more of them. So. All right, now this is, thought I had marked this, did I? There we go. Okay, this is a plot of temperature and binding energy release, this delta Q, versus density. And here's where that 50% comes from. It adds up to 150% in some cases. That as you burn at very high densities, you get a mix of alpha-rich stuff. And as you go to lower densities, you go toward the heavies, and that releases binding energy. Okay. You go to the heavies, and you can tap this much, for example, when the bubble rises up through multiple pressure or density scale heights. Jonathan, you're scowling? Is it? Okay. Now, just to show the...
Yeah, sorry. Can you repeat that point? If you're at high densities, you get alpha-rich stuff. And if that expands and you go to lower densities?
Or you burn to lower densities. It's NSE. It's a dynamical equilibrium, right? Then the alphas get absorbed and you get more on the heaviers, and that's at a lower binding energy, hence more energy release.
Okay. Yeah.
And we were able to quantify screening and without screening, which is a relatively new addition to the way you can do some of the nuclear physics. And here are time scales as a function of densities for these things. And you see that the screening adds a factor of maybe 2 or 3 to the time scales for the burning. So essentially this was parameterized, and that becomes the time scale for the artificial burning in the flame model. That's how this works. Average binding energy per nucleon. At y is equal to 0.5, the self-heating results follow this blue curve, the red curve, and I may actually be able to activate something here. Yeah, 50%, I'll go ahead and just do this. 50% nickel, 50% alphas right here. You're never going to burn beyond that because then it's no longer energetically favorable, right? I mean, the carbon and oxygen is roughly this binding energy. Here's where the self-heating results fell, and these are contours of binding energy in magnitude, so that the larger number means more energy is released. And it turns out that if you have a rising bubble, it basically goes like this, and as it starts crossing these contours, it releases more binding energy. Similarly, we got neutronization rates, and all of these were parameterized and tabularized to go into the flame model. Now, I don't want to spend much time on this, but the results that I'm going to show were from our surrogate nuclei scheme, where we picked a handful marked in the boxes here, along with neutrons and protons, these lines going off here, that span the space that we're interested in. As I mentioned, we switched over to a formulation where you just propagate things like binding energy and the electron fraction. But to illustrate the flame, I kept these pictures in here to show how it works. And here is the model flame. This is actually the whole domain, and the flame is propagating this way this time. So here's the fuel, carbon and oxygen here. And the flame, even though it's a thick flame, it's not resolvable on the plot. Here is the detail of this piece here, where you see the carbon consumption and the oxygen consumption. And then you get the silicon and stuff like that. And then as the electron fraction, this dashed line, decreases, these are mass fractions distance away from the flame, the surrogate nuclei go all to heavies. What's important is just to watch the YE curve here, because that's what changes. And I should also note that in the newest version of the flame, this is a little bit compactified some. Dean made it a lot better, and the stages can actually overlap. But
does this converge with resolution?
Yes. Okay. I mean, you could argue with me that it could conserve better, but... the point is that it's tied to the grid, okay? So it's always going to be like four zones wide or something. See, the reason these are sharp triangles is because of the point. So as you go to finer and finer, this curve will converge, but you're always going to get different behavior right in the flame.
Because different regions are going to see different densities depending on what your resolution is compared to your scale.
If you're in a region where you're going through a fairly sharp density gradient, yeah.
What's driving the change of YE?
So the things like the neutronization rates, you read from a table and then you just have a little source where you update it each time. Like you take it.
I'm sure that's an operational procedure.
No, sorry. So weak physics and neutrinos going away.
Now you want something in between those.
I mean, you got electron capture happening at certain rates behind the flame.
Sure.
And that changes the electron fraction, right? I mean, I'm trying to get.
So what? Okay. So what are the densities back there where the YE is on the order of 0.45? Or
something? So this is all pretty. I mean, there's a. It's extremely. Yeah. Yeah, it's high density. That's why this is happening so quick. If the low density result is rather boring, right? So I didn't want to just show a flat curve.
Is it a typical solution?
Yeah.
And how is the surrogate thing being used? Or is this so go away when you switch over?
It goes away when you switch over. That the fact that I have abundances for like nickel 56, nickel 58, nickel 62, nickel 64, as you start going to lower and lower YEs, the proportions of that go up. But like I said, we've switched beyond that now, because when we went to flash 3, one of the changes was we could get away from having to have species.
Okay, so this was sort of this was how you were dealing with it before, and now you're going to switch over to doing
the YE. Have switched over. Yeah. I could go on for hours, but I was thinking 5 minutes, so.
You have to stretch for the game.
Yeah. Well, we started about 5-10 minutes late, and it's our time. So here is a verification test, and this is what I did was ignite the flame in the very center of the grid, have it propagating both directions. So I've got this actually matches all my other slides that way. And there you've got a flame front here. The fuel is, of course, out here. You've got a flame front here, a flame front there. And the whole thing was in a constant velocity just drifting across the grid. And the fact that it has all this nice symmetry, which I'll have to admit we didn't actually quantify, but it looks good, right? But that demonstrated that the method is doing what it should in terms of, you know, not being skewed one way or another, and the symmetry properties are as we expect. Comment, Dean? Are you scowling?
It just means that if you advect the flame across the grid, it's all okay.
Right? Yeah.
It's wrong symmetry.
So I'll go through a little bit about noise quantification, and this is the subject of the Townsley et al. Paper, which is almost in press. And this is a plot of RMS deviation defined as the square root of something like the variance, this thing here. This was calculated in the fuel, so think of it as a measure of the noise in the fuel ahead of the flame. And this is a plot of this deviation versus time for three simulations there are actually, I guess, nine simulations in here. You've got low resolution, high resolution, very high resolution, low, medium, high. And for each one, you've got low, medium, and high densities. And so you've got low, medium, high density. These are velocity results and pressure results. The pressure, which is the important quantity, is a fairly, that's low. It's like 1 part in 10 to the 5 or below. So this is a very dense figure, but what you're supposed to take home is that the amount of noise that you get is fairly consistent with the resolution. There is an initial transient that is a sound wave from the imperfect initial conditions when you ignite the flame that then propagates away. And there are multiple sources of noise. This little fringe here comes from the flame crossing a zone. And these larger waves come from the fact that you have a pressure waves with a certain wavelength propagating through the fuel. And when you burn through a wavelength, you expect sort of a natural variation. And we have numbers that support that, but that's beyond the scope. You notice there are changes with both density and resolution. And the point is to quantify that to understand and better control.
But these also are not with subsonic boundary conditions.
Right? So
subsonic outflow
they're with outflow boundary conditions, but not satisfactorily subsonic for purists. They're not what you... Yeah.
They're zero gradient.
They're zero gradient, that's right. And Mike's point is that to really eliminate noise, you need to better handle the case there so that you don't get reflected waves at the boundary condition, which you can do, although I didn't want to do it, so...
Well, it's not that easy to do.
Yeah.
It's not at all easy.
Yeah.
Is the gross of the pressure noise down the low highest resolution an issue at all, or is that...
You're talking about as things get
a little... that guy. The blue is growing in the amplitude as we go up in time.
Our interpretation of that is that as there's less fuel, you're going to see larger variations in it. Because, I mean, at the end here, you pretty much burned all the fuel. That's what all this jazz is that it gets...
That's really... That time is just not... You didn't just arbitrarily pick 3.5. That's where you burned...
That's where he burned off the grid, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So... I think that's a pretty good stopping point. We go into another topic, so we'll just declare this noise quantification, and I'll stop there.
More questions. So, Al, can you maybe just tell us, now that the advantage. So, what advantage are you hoping for? So, you've made a phenomenological model of a flame that allows you to put it on the grid, resolve it on the grid. What's the hoped gain by doing that?
So that when we go and run a model with one of these rising bubbles,
yes,
it will meaningfully describe nature. That's the main thing. Okay. You're never really supposed to admit when you do stuff wrong, at least when you don't have tenure. But we weren't doing that earlier. Now, the overall picture hasn't changed, but...
This will get the buoyancy right.
This should get the buoyancy right. Now, there's a lot of other problems. I mean, you know, this is a model that we can apply to the long-term evolution of NSE and other astrophysics problems as well. But the devil of doing something like making a transition to a detonation is in the details. And so we want to do that as rightly as can be done.
To capture the buoyancy and capture the changing state of that fuel, because it's the same fluid element that's rising.
Yep.
Which typically you don't have in the other contexts.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
So I would say there's two important things. One is to get the buoyancy right. The other is that one of the reasons that we really push for very accurate energetics is that we would like the temperature histories of the fluid elements.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So that we can post-process them with a real reaction.
In terms of getting the energetics right, how do you, maybe this leads into your YEQ model, is that going to help in terms of getting the energetics, or is that simply a speed up?
So there's a couple things there. It's mostly a speed up, but we've had a second pass at the flame and made it better than the results that I showed when I showed the surrogate species one. It's even more realistic now. And then that's Dean's been in the driver's seat for that one, and I think maybe you'll talk to people about that. That's what I'm showing here. Yeah, yeah. These are the most contemporary results with the next generation.
If you double the size of your grid, what happens to the wavelength of that noise? Does it change?
Double the size of
the grid. Double the length of your domain.
There's a formula in the paper that'll tell you.
Yeah.
But the other question I have, though, is that if you resolve this flame, that must give you some surface tension-like behavior for the bubble. So my question is, if I imagine Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities on that, if I'm really demanding that the flame has a much thicker width, then, so I have two width possibilities, there's a difference in the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability then of that flow. So in terms of the integrity of the bubble, I would think you'd get very different answers as a function of the flame width.
It also may suppress...
First of all, am I just full of it? Is that wrong, or...?
No. I don't think it's wrong.
Well, I mean, in the specifics, I'm not sure if that's the right way to think about it. But, I mean, there are lots of things you can worry about because you have a thicker flame than reality.
One of the things we were wondering about, so we're doing resolved 3D bubble things, and the idea is you worry, can you actually shed a little spark off the Kelvin-Helmholtz and that thing? I mean, you're modeling this, but you don't actually have the convective background flow that's really there in the beginning. Also, and so
that's right.
Well, given that,
if one of these bubbles, but one of these bubbles can convect with that convective background flow and ignite somewhere else in the star.
Right.
One of these sparks, I mean.
Yeah.
There's two issues though that are just kind of getting tangled up here. One is the burning and the modeling of a flame, and the other is the interaction of that flame with hydrodynamics.
Right.
Must necessarily be in the subgrid model
rather than
the flame.
Although you are going to have things like Kelvin-Helmholtz on the grid that you're resolving in some sense. And I think that gets back to the controversy that was alluded to in the talk yesterday of arguing about what's the proper subgrid model.
I would say that you might hope that a lot of the general nature of the flow is just determined by, do you get the buoyancy right? So how fast does the bubble rise?
But doesn't the drag on the bubble depend on exactly what I just said?
Yep.
In which case, I'm not going to get the speed right.
So it depends even more so just on...
On the speed.
Well, it depends on the turbulent wake that you generate.
Right.
And you're not going to get that. So that also affects the rise speed.
That's what dominates.
How do you mean you're not going
to... We should have a talk on the physics of bubbles and water.
Yeah, right.
So that's a good thing to do in the bar, right, where you can actually do validation experiments.
We can do that after
well, what
this.
We want to know is how far can we go?
Yeah.
Understood.
Right. Yeah. When is it wrong?
Yeah.
When do these effects kill us and we cannot make predictions anymore?
Yeah,
that's what we want to know. And we don't know the answer yet.
And
so you're asking the right question.
Yep.
We are asking the same question.
Right. And you change your resolution to check that.
Yep.
And you've got a path.
Yep.
Exactly.
And
with model parameters, I mean, you want to know what the answer is.
Good.
And let me just give one more example. You know, in that case where I showed where the bubble went supersonic, you know, that was a shock wave going through fuel. And we investigated that as a way of igniting a detonation right there. And it turns out that probably isn't going to happen at all. So, you know, we're constraining the parameter space.
So this shock that you showed in the movie that... forms
the problem of the progression from the burning problem? That actually doesn't happen.
That doesn't happen, yes.
Well, that no longer happens in the simulation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Fair enough, Lars. Yeah.
The validation simulation.
Yeah. With the buoyancy
but you
that
still
we.
Still get the convergence yes. of the waves in yes. the South Pole and
yes.
the destination.
Yes, yes, yes. And they ran a big 3D simulation demonstrating that not too long ago, as folks who were here might remember. Yeah.
But just to be clear, they still didn't demonstrate that it detonates.
Okay, so.
It's extremely difficult to demonstrate from first principles that a detonation occurs.
Right, but there's evidence to suggest that you need a region bigger than what the region that was shown there was.
Right, and whereby evidence are a little bit different.
So we can meet that criteria.
Well, this is a subject of ongoing research and some controversy within the field. So let's.
On that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.